Okay, folks, thank you very much indeed for tuning in once again to Life on Planet Porky, the adventures, the excitement, the wherewithal of myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer extraordinaire, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Ms. Jones, I have to say, and the story's been well told, but you probably tell it and could have told it better than anybody else, that you have literally been all over the world on telling us all us huge fans of Fleetwood Mac, the real story behind that wonderful, genius, great songer, singer-writer woman, Christine McVie. I didn't know until I started hearing what you were saying and reading what you were saying that you knew her so well.
Yeah, it's a long time ago, you know, back in the 80s when I was posted out to the west coast of America to cover primarily rock and pop music, was for You magazine, actually, the Mail on Sunday colour supplement. And in those days, you know, we didn't have the managers, the agents, the publicists, the hangers-on, and journalists actually could get close to celebrities, rock superstars, and could befriend them and could get invited up to their house for dinner and up to their pool for a swim and all that kind of thing. Yep. And it really wasn't that unusual. People seem to think nowadays that that is the most unthinkable thing that could ever have happened. Mm. But it actually did happen.
Yeah.
And I had a lot of friends who happened to be rock superstars.
Mm. Well, that's it's a very humble statement. I had a lot of friends who are rock superstars.
Yeah, it's just the way it was. Yeah. I mean, they're not my friends today. No. Of course not. But things were different in those days. They just were.
Sure. And David Bowie, of course, was a big friend of yours. I remember you going off.
Yeah, well, that was slightly different because he was a local hero where I grew up and went to school in Bromley.
Yeah.
And he also went to a school in Bromley, Bromley Technical School. Yeah. But he lived in Beckenham, which was a short bus ride away from where I lived.
That's right.
And when we were kids at school and he had his breakthrough hits, you know, we all used to pile on the bus after school and go round there and doorstep him. So that was slightly different. That was from childhood. But it was because of him that I decided what I had to do for a living, which was grow up to live and work among rock stars.
Good thing.
So from that point of view, I did fulfill my own brief, as it were.
Thinking years ago, I read Mick Fleetwood's autobiography, and he'd just gone bankrupt. I mean, you know, how can somebody who earns $200 million go bankrupt? But he did. I don't know how, you know, it all went wrong and all that kind of stuff. And he's sitting literally on the pavement opposite the Malibu house that he's just had to sign over to the real estate agent because he's gone bankrupt and got no money. And he's saying that he's going to have to rely on, you know, the other band members to help him out and all this kind of stuff. An amazing book. But it told the whole story of how Fleetwood Mac came together. And in the end, almost everybody in Fleetwood Mac shagged somebody else and then somebody else. I mean, it was a most amazing group, wasn't it? And the way they all interacted with each other.
There was a lot of inter-band mingling, shall we call it.
Yeah.
And Christine McVie explained this quite succinctly. She said, you know, the song The Chain that's on the Rumours album, the 1977 album, the one we call the divorce album, in fact.
Yes.
That song, The Chain, which is probably better known in this country anyway as the Formula One theme tune.
That is, yeah.
With that very sort of...
Bum, 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 bum.
That's the one.
She said... Bum, 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 bum. Yeah.
She said that everyone thought that was about, you know, all kinds of things. There were all sorts of explanations.
Yeah.
She said, in fact, that song was about the five of us and about never break the chain. Don't be the one to break away and break the connection, because once you do that, that's the magic of us lost.
Yeah.
Because the magic of Fleetwood Mac was all about chemistry.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. When I got booted out of the Express by Sir Nicholas Lloyd, after 6 years as news editor, he gave me two options. One, to just take a huge payoff. Or secondly, do you want to go back to America and follow Bill Clinton on the campaign trail for a year, which I thought would be great, you know, fun, great experience. Lots of money, I have to add, and, you know, lots of five-star hotels and all that kind of stuff. So I did that, and it all ended up with me going to Bill Clinton's inauguration party in January after he got inaugurated, obviously after winning the election. And one of Bill Clinton's people came to me and said, this was a month before, the president wants Fleetwood Mac to play at his inauguration ball. Oh, I said, well, what? Yeah, he wants them to play Don't Stop, you know, Talking About Tomorrow, which had been a tune he'd used on the campaign trail. He said, can you help us out? And of course, I didn't have any contacts in the world of rock and roll shop business, show business, but I rang somebody up and, you know, I knew, said, yes, okay, fine. And within like a day, I had the exclusive story, you know, Fleetwood Mac, you know, will be, you know, appearing at President Clinton's inauguration party, playing live, Don't Stop, you know, Talking About Tomorrow. And she wrote that, didn't she?
Yes, she did. So the Rumours album, she wrote, there are 11 tracks on that album. Mm. She wrote purely herself and sang on her own. Yeah. Four out of the 11 songs on that album.
That's amazing.
And co-wrote The Chain as well. So, you know, effectively half the album is her. Mm. And it's interesting because the world thinks that Stevie Nicks was the face and the voice of Fleetwood Mac, or still is, I should say.
Well, she was certainly but the actually, face. One of the most beautiful women in the history of rock music, in my view.
Yeah. But her voice is the one, you know, if you ask most people who's the woman in Fleetwood Mac, most people would say Stevie Nicks.
That's right, yeah.
But in fact, Christine McVie was a more fundamental part of the band.
Yep.
She'd been there longer than Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham. They only came into the lineup when Fleetwood Mac, who weren't really doing very much in the UK in the 70s, couldn't give it away.
Yeah.
So they decided to move to America.
Yeah.
And then in came Buckingham Nicks as a duo, as part of the lineup. And that brought a new sound to the music, really, and it sort of took off from there.
Absolutely and utterly amazing. This isn't going to be a total rock and roll podcast, folks, but, you know, Miss Jones knows everything about everything, and so we can't leave it without talking, because this hadn't happened when we did our last podcast, about the sad demise of Irene Cara. I mean, honestly, Leslie-Ann, to me, you know, Flesh Dance, What a Feeling, da 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 da. That is one of the iconic tunes of my life.
Something about that, yeah. But, you know, she was more famous for Fame, I think.
I don't think so. I think Flesh Dance was one of the greatest theme tunes to... I didn't think the film was that good. I saw the film, you know, this one.
She wasn't in the film. She only did the soundtrack.
I know.
Yeah.
Jennifer Beals, I think, was the actress in the film, wasn't she?
I think it was,
And she was very beautiful. A ridiculous plot about her wanting to be a ballet dancer but took a job as a welder during the day. I mean, it was ludicrous and all that kind of stuff. But the sheer musical power of Flashdance, oh, I loved it.
It's quite a long time ago, and I think many people in this country thought that she'd faded away because the musical film Fame was back in, I think, 1980. Mm. Flashdance wasn't long after that. And then she sort of didn't do much as far as we're concerned, but she had a long career in America.
Yeah.
And she did, what was it, the other song from that film, Out Here on My Own, which is quite a well-known song.
Is it? Mm.
And it was the first time that two songs sung by the same artist were nominated in the same category for an Oscar.
Good God.
Which is pretty interesting, isn't it? So she would have had the chance to sing one or two of those songs. She reached her peak, I think it's fair to say, with that title song of Flashdance, which she didn't write by herself. She wrote the lyrics, and Giorgio Moroder wrote the music.
A genius composer. I read all this up. You're absolutely right, yeah.
So they shared the Oscar on that. And she had a lot of fame in America. Then came this point where she started claiming that she'd been blacklisted, and it's one of those pre-kind of racist scenarios.
Right.
She said that the producers of Flashdance had withheld royalties from her. In fact, she was awarded $1.5 million in that court case.
Wow.
And then sort of faded away again, and she died at home. but they haven't said what off. No. So I wonder if we'll ever find out.
She's very
young. Only 63.
That's what I was going to say, yes, so young, 63, unbelievable. You know, there we go. Right, okay, that's enough rock star stuff, because we are in the middle now of a very, very exciting sporting adventure. That's to put it mildly, okay? As this podcast is released, England are moving into the quarterfinals against France, who are the world champions and who've got probably the world's best player, Mbappe, who's replaced sort of Lionel Messi, and Ronaldo is the outstanding player of this tournament. And it all happens in a couple of days' time on Saturday night. Miss Jones, I know that your antecedents are Welsh, but can you get excited about the way England are moving forward in this tournament?
Well, I'm still not watching it. As you know, the same principles still apply. We can't relax on this. You know, everybody's gone, oh, well, yeah, England are doing well, might as well watch it. I am not watching it. And it's the reason wars happen, Mike, because people start turning a blind eye. That situation in Qatar is still the same as it was before. Yeah. And anyone who is now excited about the World Cup and is cheering England on and taking part is all contributing to the plight of those people. I'm sorry, I haven't changed my mind about this.
A lot of people have changed their mind. You're absolutely right. And I do admire your principles for sticking with it. But a lot of people now are saying, let's just get on with the football, you know, never mind the politics and all that kind of stuff. But you're absolutely
at
right.
At the expense of people's lives. Yeah. I mean, you know, pause for a minute, guys, and just think about what it's like to live there.
On the other hand, of course, people say, well, you know, FIFA awarded it to them. It was a very corrupt process. We all know that. But now that they've awarded it to them, if you go there as a football fan, then I'm sorry, you have to accept the principles of life in Qatar. And
we shouldn't have gone in the first place. England should not be there. The Welsh should not have been there. But you can't just go, oh, well, it's the way it is, so let's get on with the football. I'm sorry, it doesn't wash for me.
Yeah, well, as I say, a lady of true principle, Miss Jones, and I accept all that. What's your favourite shoe? Because I've seen this fantastic survey, right? Adidas has been voted the top footwear brand of the last century. That's of the 20th century. That's 100 years. And the German company, which is worth £24 billion, topped the number of shoe companies in the survey ahead of Dr. Martens, Nike and Clarks. But it does mention within here, Miss Jones, a couple of shoes which you may have a view on. One of them is Christian Louboutin. And the other one is Jimmy Choo. Do you have a pair of either?
I've got a pair of Jimmy Choos. I haven't worn them for years. In fact, I think I only wore them once and they crippled me. They cost a bloody fortune. Mm-hmm. They were hundreds of pounds.
Are these high-heeled shoes, are they?
They're very high-heeled, yes. Right. They're gorgeous. They've got a little platform sole. I mean, they look really lovely in the box, but you can't walk in these things. I don't wear high heels at all anymore. Mm. I don't really know what a survey like this means, because I don't buy shoes according to brand. I'll buy a pair of shoes because I need something like a low heeled boot, or a new cowboy boot or something like that, or a new pair of trainers. But I'm not going to go, oh, it's got to be Adidas or it's got to be Clarks or whatever. Having said that, the most comfortable pair of shoes I've ever bought, last summer I was hobbling around crippled. I tell you where I'd been, to Dame Vera Lynn's memorial service at Westminster Abbey.
Right.
And I was wearing a sort of low-heeled suede boot, very nice, sort of went with the outfit I was wearing. Mm-hmm. But they were crippling me. And I hobbled along Victoria Street to a branch of Clarks,
right,
where they had wallabies in the window. Mm. Wallabies have been around for years. Like my daughter said, people, they're a sort of crepe-soled lace-up shoe with a round toe.
Right.
And you can get them in various colours, and they're suede. They're very, very soft. Or nubuck, I think they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw these in the window, and I thought, I've got to go in and buy some. They weren't cheap.
Mm.
I put them on my feet. They were like slippers. They were just gorgeous. And I've worn them to death since then.
Right.
And I was at a lunch yesterday where one of the other lunch guests was wearing a sort of beige pair. And we got to talking about when they were at school, kids used to wear them as school shoes. So that is a style of shoe that's stuck around. And that is Clarks.
It's not very rock and roll, is it? Having a conversation.
Yes, but no, you're wrong. No, you're wrong, because Clarks have become a very cool shoe. Ooh. In recent years. Oh, it's a retro thing.
Well, we used to go as kids. We used to get our feet measured, literally measured on a ball.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But that Clark's Wallaby, have a look at them online.
Right.
That Clark's Wallaby is a really popular, cool shoe now.
Ooh, right. Well, I'll take your word for it, Miss Turner, but I would never have thought of it. When I'm down on the coast, right, I got a Gunwharf key, which is in Portsmouth, and it's a massive, great new shop. Is that what I say new? It's been there about 20 years now. It's revitalised the whole of the city. But there's a Nike store, and I mean, this is such a big Nike store. It's so active that you go in one day, you buy a pair of new Nike trainers. If you went back the next day, that pair's not there. It's amazing the turnover of different products that they do. You know what I mean? It's just incredible. And I've probably got, I would think, about 20 pairs of Nike trainers in boxes, which may have been opened once, may have been worn once, but some of them haven't been, because I just like buying Nike trainers and I walk past it. Usually I've had a drink or two.
A few sherbets, yeah, I was going to say. What on earth does somebody like you need 20 pairs of Nike trainers
for? You don't,
for?
But they just look so great. And you've got to remember, they're updating them all the time. You know, it's a bit like your cars. You know, the new model of the car looks better than the old model of the car, and the new model of the Nike trainer looks better than the last one. But anyway, look, it's just one of those things. Years ago, I don't know if you remember this, Mick Jagger got a knighthood, and I think he took about 18 months before he actually agreed a date to go to the palace and be knighted. Okay, and when he got there, he had a black jacket, a black suit on, and a shirt and tie, but he had trainers on, and everybody, you know, lambasted him and said, you know, that's really disrespectful. But you know what? When I'm working now, and I have to, you know, go to a TV studio or something like that, it is very difficult to concentrate properly if you've got slip-on or lace-up leather shoes. I don't know why, but you're worrying about them all the time. It is so much easier to wear trainers which wrap around your feet and feel so comfortable.
Why are you worried about them? What are they going to do while you're talking away on television?
Well, it's not that. It's walking in and out of the studios and all that kind of stuff, and they kind of slip off your feet and all that. All I'm saying is I just feel much more comfortable wearing trainers. So I'm assuming that when Mick Jagger eventually went to the palace, he wasn't trying to be disrespectful. He just felt, you know, more comfortable on his feet at his age. I think he was about 70 then or something like that, wearing trainers than wearing leather shoes. And I can understand that.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because Charlie Watts, who famously wore priceless handmade shoes, and he had dozens and dozens of pairs of them.
Right.
And he said he would never dream of wearing trainers. Mm. And he was very scathing of the other lot, as he called
right.
his bandmates,
right.
for prancing around in trainers all the time.
Yeah.
He would only ever wear proper shoes, even when he was drumming on stage.
Wow, that's amazing.
So, yeah, he favoured this sort of very soft moccasin. I suppose you call them a type of driving shoe.
Yeah.
You know, they have those sort of rubber yeah. bits that come up the back.
Sure.
But beautiful handmade ones. You can get them in that Piccadilly Arcade
yeah.
in London, where they have all the handmade shoe shops
right.
in there. But,
right.
you know, up to £1,000 a pair.
But a drummer uses one of his feet to constantly pump a pedal, which hits his bass drum or something, doesn't he? So he must have been aware of that with his shoes on. By the way, I read a piece today. I think this is the anniversary of the death of John Bonham, talking about drummers, okay? And John Bonham, of course, was the drummer for Led Zeppelin, yeah?
Yeah.
And it said that the minute John Bonham died, every other member of the group decided that was it was all over. Unlike Queen, who you know very well, you've written books about them and all that, they decided they couldn't go on. And I don't think they've ever even met up ever since, have they?
Oh, yeah, they have. I mean, they famously played at Live Aid, for example.
What, without John Bonham?
Yeah.
I didn't know.
I'm trying to remember who they had drum for them that day, and it's not come back. But
yeah.
no, they did perform for Live Aid in July 1985.
But they've never made a studio album, have they, since?
No, but they They, oh, I tell you who it was. Mm. Of course it was. Phil Collins drummed with them that day. And he famously flew from having done a performance in at Wembley Stadium, got on the Concorde, if you recall, and flew to Philadelphia and got up with Led Zeppelin. They said that his performance was so bad that they refused to allow the footage of their sequence, their performance, to be used on the video.
What, because they thought he was no good?
Well, it wasn't good enough for them. Maybe that was just their excuse, because how could you say that Phil Collins wasn't any good, really?
Yeah, that's quite amazing, isn't it? Yeah,
yeah. It just wasn't to their liking. But, I mean, they're famously very skittish and a law unto themselves, really. But Robert Plant, their lead singer, their front man, has done a lot of solo music down the years and has... He's made a fantastic career as a solo artist, actually. Yeah. You should check out his work with Alison Krauss, the country singer, because that is just really quite sublime.
I certainly will. I've never heard of her, but I certainly will. Listen.
Yeah, you should have heard of Alison Krauss. She's amazing.
Well, I haven't actually, but I will definitely look her up on your recommendation, Miss Jones.
Yeah, Krauss, K-R-A-U-S-S.
I've written that down. I haven't really, but I'll remember it. Now, I don't want to get too nostalgic, but these things happen. And in this week, sadly, George Harrison sent a final message of love. I'm reading this from something I've picked up. To the world yesterday before losing his battle against cancer. Just like John Lennon, his widow had the funeral, had George cremated, has never said where it was or what happened to his ashes before she announced to the world that George had died. Is that because they don't want to have, you know, the situation where people are going to a monument, which is a gravestone somewhere in the world, to pay homage to the great rock star?
Well, this is very common among rock celebrities, rock artists of international esteem. Yeah. John Lennon, for example, didn't have a funeral of any kind.
None at all.
And no, nothing at all. How could you, if you're an international idol of such magnitude, how could you possibly have a funeral? Because it would be inundated with thousands and thousands of people from all over the world. Yeah. It would be a circus. And a funeral is something very personal to a family. It's the last experience you have of that person. The last time you're in their presence,
it's true,
dead or alive. Yeah. And so that should remain a family moment and it should be private. Mm. So for that reason, lots of them don't have funerals. Freddie Mercury had a funeral, but it was a family affair with close friends and so on. Mm. But interestingly there, he's buried in an unknown location. I've been there. Mm-hmm. I know where he is.
Right.
But it has never been announced to the world where his remains are.
And you're not telling anybody, Miss Jones?
No, absolutely not, because I do not want to be the one who invites desecration of that grave.
Yeah.
You know, you do get mad mental fans who will go to somebody's grave and will dig it up.
Yes.
You probably remember Brian Jones was buried in an iron casket, and he's buried so deeply into the ground that nobody could actually get to his coffin.
Yeah.
But they have to take these kind of measures. But I mean, his funeral was an absolute circus.
Yeah.
It was a bun fight, and you don't want that.
Where did dignity? Where did that take place?
That was up in Cheltenham in Gloucestershire, where he was from and where his family still lives.
Father was a minister, wasn't he? I think a churchman.
No, he wasn't. But Stuart White, you probably remember from the News of the World.
True,
he was West Coast correspondent. That was his first job as a reporter, was covering the funeral and the burial of Brian Jones.
Golly, that's absolutely amazing, isn't it? I don't know, these rock stars, they have different lives to the rest of us, don't they?
Oh, yes.
Okay, folks, you must fancy a free case of delicious beers as the festive season is all around us. And it's a World Cup festive season. That makes it better, does it not? And right now, your very good friends and mine, Beer 52, have this great offer. They've got this great deal. Yes, a free case of 8 craft beers. I mean it. Simply go to www.beer52.com/porky, okay? And all you have to do is to cover the very humble postage cost of £5.95 to claim your free case. Now, I've been a member of Beer 52, folks, for many moons, and I love it. Unashamedly, I'm telling you, I love it, okay? Each month, they send their members a new case of beer from a different part of the world. What a Christmas you can have! Tasting those planet-wide beers and a World Cup with world-flavoured beers, okay? Beers from 40 countries, over five continents, juicy pales to strong-tasting stouts. We're the world's number one beer club, Beer 52. Number one beer club in the world. Dark or light, it's all there. You also get our Ferment magazine. That's what it's called. It's called Ferment. And you get some tasty snacks in that box of beers that'll come to you. And if you're not satisfied, and this is, you know, a really lovely gesture. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel at any time. So that's www.beer52.com/Porky, P-O-R-K-Y, to claim your free case right now. I'll give you that just one more time. It's www.beer52.com/Porky to claim your free case right now. Just pay the postage. That's it. Right, okay, folks. Thank you very much indeed for tuning in today, listening to myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, the rock chick writer, Ms. Leslie Ann Jones. Leslie Ann, we're getting close to Christmas. Now, we don't want to get all jingle bells and all that, but I saw a fantastic spread this morning on the Christmas number ones going right back to the 70s. And, of course, and we mentioned this before just a couple of weeks ago, your old mate Noddy Holder, you know, who has the rights over the most famous ever Christmas number one. So here it is, Merry Christmas, everybody's having fun. This year has sold it to Iceland, not the country, but Iceland, the obviously the supermarket that sells lots of frozen stuff. And the adverts are great, and they play it in the background, all that kind of stuff. But is that the greatest ever Christmas number one, Slade? It is for me, to be honest. I was about 18 at the time, and I think it's fantastic. And some of the others, which I look at now, and I'm just reading through the list here, Miss Jones, you're a lot younger than me, but do you remember things like Mary's Boy Child, Boney M, Another Brick in the Wall, Pink Floyd?
Well, that's not a Christmas song, Another Brick in the Wall.
Well, it was number one at Christmas.
Yeah, it's number one at Christmas, but it's not a Christmas single. It wasn't written about Christmas or with a Christmas theme.
No, but
it just happened to be number one that year.
All right, well, what about the following year? Don't you want me, baby?
Yeah, Humanly, yeah. That's not a Christmas song. I think we have to differentiate between songs that were composed about Christmas and songs that just happened to hit the top of the charts during the Christmas week of the charts. It doesn't mean anything nowadays because the charts don't operate. Yeah. There isn't just one chart anyway, but the charts don't operate the way they once did. So the whole notion of becoming the Christmas number one is meaningless today.
Yeah, cool.
But it's interesting because I've got my daughter staying with me at the moment.
Right.
And just before we started to record the podcast, I said to her, write down your favorite two Christmas singles.
Right.
And I wrote down my favourite two Christmas singles, and we both chose exactly the same two.
Oh, go on.
Which is Fairy Tale of New York by The Pogues with Kirsty MacColl.
Right.
And Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time by Macca.
Simply Having a Wonderful Christmas Time. Now,
that's the one.
Now, because I've got a manual in front of me with all the information, I've got some very bad news for you, Miss Jones.
No, don't tell me what.
I'm going to tell you that The Pogues, Kirsty MacColl, Fairy Tale of New York, only got to number two and lost out to the Pet Shop Boys.
Yeah, you see, I wouldn't even put those two in the same category. But it's another thing. So we were having a conversation about obscure Christmas songs.
Yeah.
Nothing to do with chart placings or anything like that.
Yeah.
But my dear friend Nick Fitzherbert, who sadly died about 3 years ago, Mia and I went to spend Christmas in New York, and he made us a little recording on a CD which we were all still using in those days. Mm-hmm. And he said, when you're in the cab going from Kennedy into Manhattan, yeah. put this on your player and listen to it on the way in. Yeah. And it's an amazing Christmas song called A New York Christmas by a singer-songwriter called Rob Thomas. I bet you've never even heard it.
I haven't.
There's another one to listen to because it's gorgeous. Mm. And then she said, what about the Joni Mitchell one? I said, I didn't know Joni Mitchell had done a Christmas song. And she said, oh, yeah. It's got this jingle bell sort of refrain. So she pulled it up and we were listening to it. It's exquisite. And it's called River.
Yeah.
It's a very sad song, very little known, but it's a lovely, lovely Christmas song. I thoroughly recommend it.
Right. I've got more bad news for you. Paul McCartney, Wonderful Christmas Time, 1979, beaten by the one we've already mentioned, Pink Floyd.
Yeah, well, it means nothing because, as I said, it's not. It's a difference between chart placing and a specially composed Christmas song. I'll give you another two, which I always reach for Christmas time. Wish I Could Be Home for Christmas by Jonah Louie, the one that goes dubba dubba dum dum dubba dubba dum dubba dum dubba dum dubba dum. There's that one, and also the immense Chris Rea with Driving Home for Christmas.
I love it.
So whenever we play that, my son goes, "Is he there yet?"
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, he tells a great story, Chris Rea, doesn't he, that he was so broke at the time. He'd been working in London. His royalties hadn't come through. He didn't know what to do. He drove home to Middlesbrough, I think it was, where he lives in the northeast. And it was so cold. They opened the door of their house and it was colder inside than it was out.
Oh, God.
But there was a pile of mail on the inside doormat, carpet, whatever. And he picked it all up, and within there was a royalty check for $50,000 for his previous song, Road to Hell.
Oh, what a great song that is as well. Interesting that they were both road songs, isn't it?
It is, yeah, absolutely interesting indeed.
I love Christmas songs. I never get bored with them. It's that there's just something so special because when we were young, the Christmas single was such a big deal.
Yeah.
But now we've got all those songs at our fingertips. We can drag them out every year.
Yeah.
One thing I hate is the way supermarkets start playing them in November because you're bored with them by the time Christmas comes.
Yeah.
And I still want to be listening to George Michael on Christmas Day.
Yeah,
Last Christmas is the kind of classic Christmas love song, isn't it?
Gave me your heart, but the very next day you gave it away this year. Now I think the next line is so I don't
to save you from tears, I'll save it for someone special.
Someone special, absolutely.
Yeah. What a great song. Yeah. What a great loss.
That Kirsty MacColl one, by the way, I got to know Kirsty MacColl's husband very well, who was the
Steve Lillywhite,
producer of U2 and all that kind of stuff. And we sat there one night having a drink and he actually talked me through the whole tragedy of, you know, Kirsty MacColl getting killed. We've talked about this before. She was killed when she was swimming. She collided with a speedboat, which...
she was swimming with her boys, her children, and a speedboat was coming very fast towards them.
That's right.
She pushed them out of the way and she died. But Steve Lillywhite had left her by then.
Yes.
I mean, he wasn't kind to her at all.
Well, I don't know about that. All I know is he told me that she was the main brain behind the great U2 LP, the Shack Shack Tree, was it called? What was it called?
The Joshua Tree.
Joshua Tree, that's right. And she sorted out all the tracks and she laid it all out and all that kind of stuff. Apparently
she was an amazing musician. Yeah. She really was. Yeah. She's such a loss to music.
Yeah.
There's a lovely bench in Soho Square,
More
or less opposite MPL, McCartney's offices.
Yeah.
And you can go in there if ever you're in town in the spring or the summer.
Yeah.
Go and get your lunchtime sandwich and a little drink and sit there. Mm. It's got a plaque to her on it.
Yeah.
And you can sit there and think about Kirsty. She was a lovely person. I knew her. We used to go to the Lamb and Flag around the back of the Christmas
records
office. Oh,
in Covent Garden. Yeah.
No, not Covent Garden, just off Oxford Street. Not that Lamb and Flag where you and I went.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. Right.
Yeah, just off Oxford Street.
Oh, I know it. Yeah, I do know it. It's very near Oxford Circus Tube Station, isn't it?
Exactly, that one.
Yeah, I know, yeah.
Yeah, but she was lovely, down to earth, very pretty in a very natural sort of way, which wasn't very 80s. You know, 80s was all about kind of lurid makeup and sparky hair and stuff, but she wasn't like that.
No, I don't know anything about lurid makeup and sparky hair, Miss Jones. But
I bet you do after dark.
Well, I don't think so.
There's no telling what you get up to when we're not looking.
Well, Miss Jones, you know, I'm not going to delve into my...
But it is a family show, I know.
It's a family show. Now, I was on a TV show just a couple of days ago, and it was the day of the week when we review what we've seen on the TV. And I'd seen this amazing program about Ulrika Jonsson and Sven Hein Eriksson, you know, and the, you know, the sort of failed affair. And I have to say, because I was around those days, you know, working in football, I'd left the FA by then, but we were doing a lot of broadcasting and we used to bump into Sven all the time. And Sven, he really had an eye for the women. And he always admitted that. He said, I like women, you know, doesn't everybody, and all this kind of stuff, you know. And of course, he had this affair with Ulrika Jonsson, which we didn't know about until she announced the affair. It was over. That was an amazing thing. But anyway, so there's this one-hour programme on Sven, and when Sven meets Ulrika and all that. And I think the most embarrassing thing for Sven, and Sven doesn't get easily embarrassed, by the way, was that... he used to leave his shoes outside Ulrika's bedroom door when he was staying there at her house so that Ulrika's nanny would know not to come in. But the shoes had lifts in them. And for the benefit of our millions of listeners, lifts are shoes that have 1 or 2 inches inside the shoe to make the person wearing them look a bit taller. That surprised me. I didn't know Sven was that worried about his own persona.
All these celebrity males are worried about their image, aren't they? But, you know, this affair sort of smacked a bit of John Major and Edwina Curry to me. There was something slightly distasteful about it. And all I want to say to Ulrika now is just shut up moaning. She shagged him. You know, she can dish it out, but she can't take it back. I think it happened, but she can't moan about whatever anybody says about it because she talked about it enough herself.
Yeah.
So is she surprised that people have made a program about this? It's, look, you know, anyone can say, oh, it wasn't like that. It wasn't accurate. But if you make a relationship public, you have to expect that people will offer their opinions.
Yes. No, I totally agree. I mean, Ulrich has had a very interesting life. You know, I once worked with Stan Collymore and I never...
Oh, he used to knock her about, didn't he?
Oh, he did knock her about. They were in France, I think, and I think it was a Rugby World Cup or something like that. I can't quite remember. But he didn't just knock her about. He smacked her, he punched her in the face, knocked her to the floor, and started kicking her. And before Stan Collymore rings up his lawyers and threatens to sue me, which he's done half a dozen times before, but I've never heard from Stan's lawyers, there are several witnesses to what actually happened there, you know.
No, it's all been written about.
Exactly. But Stan had a particularly cruel way of describing Ulrika. He called her a knackered old 4x4. So a 4x4.
Four children before, didn't men, hadn't she?
Exactly. Mm. And of course, a 4x4 to most of us is a car. You know, it's a Chelsea.
Well, lots of footballers have had 4x4s, 5x5s, 6x6s, you know. Yeah.
But
let's not do any mudslinging here.
Ulrika must have seen the programme because, you know, a couple of days later, she wrote a column. She writes a column in a national newspaper. And she says, I vowed I wouldn't watch it. I knew it would probably send me into a spin. Apart from anything else, in the most genuinely self-deprecating way, I find it very hard to watch myself on screen, whatever you might think. But actually, you know, when you're at the centre of a publicity bubble, nobody regrets it really, do they?
Not really. I can't. I mean, look, she's in the public eye. She's writing a column. She's drawing attention to that programme by writing about it.
Exactly. She led a column on it. And I think it was on Channel 5, so it would have had a decent audience and all that. But she, I mean, you're absolutely right what I just said. If she really felt that, you know, it's beneath me, she should have just ignored it, shouldn't she?
Yes, that's what I said. Yeah. Stop moaning. Yeah. Shut up and stop moaning, woman.
Exactly. Now, a bloke I've interviewed many times, I say a bloke because he's a very blokish bloke, is Charlie Mullins. And Charlie Mullins is a plumber, but he's not an ordinary plumber. He founded and kept going for nearly 4 to 5 years, Pimlico Plumbers, okay? So a London boy, starts off as a plumber, then decides I'm going to expand and make it into a business, and it became massive. And it wasn't just plumbing, it was the electricians and joiners and everything. And he sold out, I think about 18 months ago, for 145 million quid. And I've interviewed him a number of times on radio shows. Charlie's now 70, but he often has the mickey taken out of him because he's... I can't say he's had his hair done. I don't know if he has, but his hair is often compared to Rod Stewart's spiky stick-up hair. And I can't say he's had his face done. He's 70 years of age, but he has a very youthful appearance about him. So I will give him the benefit of the doubt and say, you know, he keeps himself in shape and he's very active and all that kind of stuff. But what really struck me about the piece I read about him just quite recently is that he's determined now to spend his money after selling his business for £145 million. And one way he's spending it is that he will be spending Christmas and New Year at the 7-star hotel in Dubai, which is called something like the Al Herb Juba or something like that. I can never remember the name of it, right? But it's £5,000 a night.
You might say that. I couldn't possibly comment.
You couldn't possibly comment. But it's £5,000 a night for 30 nights. So that's £150,000 for a Christmas break. I mean...
Well, he can't take it with him, can he?
Yeah.
And who was it said in the way back that if a rich man leaves a fortune, then he lived a poor life?
Yeah, well...
You've got to make money work for you. You can't take it with you to your grave.
Yeah, no, I totally agree with you. And so he's determined to do it. But what I like about it is that he's completely flamboyant about his wealth, whereas many people try to hide the fact that they're wealthy. I get really annoyed when successful people think they've got to be shameful about their success, think they've got to hide it, think they've got to be humble about it. No, no, no. If we could bring into our society that success and creating wealth and, you know, creating jobs and just being good and going out there is actually an asset and should be commended rather than frowned upon, we'd be a better society, wouldn't we?
Yeah, possibly. Possibly.
It doesn't seem...
It's a double-edged sword, that one, isn't it?
Why is it? Why is it a double-edged sword?
Well, we might need to work on that one a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's come back to it.
Well, I suppose we could. I like wealthy people because I always feel that they have an expanse and expression within their lives that most of us don't have, because most of us are trying to pay the bills every day, which I...
Well, that's very true. But most, well, I would say not all wealthy people have generated their own wealth through their own endeavour and hard work. Look at all the Russian oligarchs, for example, and look at how that has all come unstuck. Look at the children of celebrities who've inherited vast fortunes and then squandered them. Yeah. Look at the lottery winners who, because they haven't had to earn the money they've suddenly found themselves with, end up ruining their lives.
Well, okay.
So money can be the root of all evil, and I think the key is having worked hard for it.
Yeah, well, I will qualify what I said. I like people who've made their own fortunes, and I like to see them enjoying them. You know what I mean?
That I agree with.
And I commend them. Now, Dr. Michael Mosley is the doctor who writes in the Daily Mail. Fascinated by this piece he wrote, how you can tell when someone's lying to you. And I read it 2 or 3 times. And I still couldn't get what the absolutely significant indication is. You know, is it their eyes flicker? Is it that they start blushing? Is it that they stammer? I just couldn't get it. I don't know if you saw the same piece, Leslie Ann.
Yeah, I did see it. I read it, and I've read other stuff about this subject as well, because I was married to a liar, not beating around the bush. I'm an intelligent woman, right?
Yeah.
I have often been lied to, and I haven't been able to tell. And I can read body language quite well, I think.
Yeah.
You read in one piece that it's all about shrugging and lack of expression and a strange bored posture. Yeah. And other people will tell you it's all about grooming behaviors, like playing with your hair or pressing your fingers together or not making eye contact, that sort of thing. I have been in situations where I've looked out specifically for those signs to see whether someone's lying to me. And I haven't been able to tell and have later found out that the person has lied to me. Mm. So I think this is all guesswork. There's no science to it.
Yeah.
There's no hard and fast rules. No, but there's no blueprint. Mm. It's a bit like people who read dreams. You know, you get these people who are sort of dream interpreters.
Yeah.
And they sometimes have columns in newspapers. And this person will answer the queries of people who write in about their dreams. What does it mean if I fall off a cliff in my dream? Mm. Or if a dog is chasing me or whatever it is?
Yeah.
And this dream interpreter gives them an interpretation. And I think to myself, well, that's only their guess.
Exactly.
Nothing's been handed down from on high
yeah.
to say that this is the exact specific interpretation of that dream. And I think this thing about lying is the same.
Mm. It's what I can't quite understand is that I think that it's nothing to do with facial expressions and all that. I believe in the old adage that if something sounds too good to be true,
It usually is.
Yeah. And I think you've got to, understand your gut instincts. Believe your gut instincts and all that kind of stuff to see whether it's not. I was quite recently, I'm not sure if I've told you this, Miss Jones, when we've talked, but quite recently I was approached by a bloke who said he represented a consortium, okay, who wanted to start a radio station in Saudi Arabia, a sports radio station, okay? And they researched and looked around and found out that I was the perfect guy to go out to Saudi Arabia to set it all up and then become the main breakfast show presenter on this new radio station in Saudi Arabia, you know? And again, I thought, yeah, how much are you going to pay me? He said, £10,000 a week. I said, right. And I said, what's that? Oh, well, that'd be a 2-year contract. Oh, that's £1 million then. Yeah. Right, that sounds great. I tell you what, let's have a meeting. And you bring along some documents, bring along some evidence, bring along. So he said, it's all backed by the Saudi Arabian Sovereign Fund. And he claimed the same people who have financed Newcastle United. I said, right, well, in that case, we can go to Newcastle, can't we? And honestly, the minute I questioned it, it just fell away. But why would people get into sort of, airy-fairy, ridiculous nonsense like that?
But usually because they're trying to get you to do something for nothing
right.
on a promise.
Oh, that's absolutely right. Absolutely right. He said to me, we can fly out there during the World Cup because Newcastle United are playing friendlies, and we can go with them. I said, okay. I said, well, look, if it's £10,000 when I start working for them, then I'm afraid it's going to be £10,000 a week if you want me to spend a week in Saudi Arabia, trying to set this up. Oh, right. Okay. Haven't heard from the bloke since,
Yeah, because another aspect of it will be that they'll be using your name to try and get something like this off the ground.
Maybe.
So the minute you show a bit of interest, oh, yeah, we've nabbed him. You've got Mike Parry on board.
Yeah.
And they can then go to their potential investors and say, we've got Mike Parry. And that might make a difference in terms of bringing in the money.
It could be. I mean, I'm not a huge star, but I did start Talk Sport. It became the
biggest. Don't talk yourself down, Mike.
And most successful sports radio station.
And look at the millions of listeners you've attracted to Planet Porky as well.
Well, you're absolutely right. Just before we go, let's leave it on a lighter note. In this week, in 1966, Tom Jones was at number one with "The Green, Green Grass of Home." Do you know, I think Tom Jones is not given nearly enough respect for what a brilliant performer and singer he is.
He's still going and he's 82 and he still sounds. I've caught a couple. I don't really make a habit of watching The Voice, but I've caught a couple of bits on it where he's got up and sung, and they present it as though it's completely spontaneous. Come on, Tom, give us a song. Yeah. And he gets up and he belts it.
Yeah.
And he belts it as well, if not better, than he did when he was a young man.
Yeah.
That is a singer. That is a proper singer. And I've always loved the boyo.
Yeah.
I was brought up on the boyo.
Yeah.
The only thing about him, He was a mega shagger.
Oh, yeah.
And he used to leave his wife at home while he shagged his way around the world.
He did.
And
Miss Worlds. He had a thing for Marjorie Wallace, didn't he? The American Miss Worlds.
That's right, yeah.
And all that,
yeah. But he had his wife, Linda, Melinda, she was called, but yeah. They called her Linda.
Yeah.
He left her at home and off he went, wenching and wassailing all over the globe.
Yeah.
And then when she died in 2016, he was absolutely devastated.
Yeah.
And he's never got over it. So that is one big bundle of remorse.
Mm.
Tom Jones.
Yeah, but he was quite honest about it, and so was she, wasn't she? I mean, in the
sense, no, she was a recluse. She never spoke.
But
she was never given a chance to speak. Well, she probably did, but was she ever given a choice?
Well,
and I think his view was, oh, well, I always go home to her, so what's she worried about? Well, that's not good enough in this day and age, is it? I always go home to her, therefore she has to put up with the rest of it. And that's my one criticism of him, because I do think he's the most incredible artist.
Yeah.
He recorded a Bond theme as well, didn't he? Was it Thunderball or something?
And he strikes like Thunderball. Yeah, it was
something like that.
I'm sure I've told you this story before, and I'm sure I've told our millions of listeners, but my first ever visit to New York was a package holiday with a mate of mine when I was 22, and we flew out of Manchester Airport to the West Coast, and it was a three-city, sort of package trip. We landed in San Francisco, first time I've ever been there, fantastic. Then we went to Los Angeles, and that was very average because I couldn't quite work out what Los Angeles was about. And then we went to Las Vegas, which was stunning. I mean, I used to play at the $2 tables all night because if you stayed there for more than an hour, they give you free cocktails, and all that kind of stuff. But point of my story is, my mate and I were just wandering along the strip one night and literally saw, Tom Jones live in concert. I'm not sure where it was. It might have been Caesar's Palace, might have been somebody else. And we thought, no, we just can't walk in and watch Tom Jones, can we? So we went up and they said, yeah, guys, no problem at all. He's on air, he's on stage at 9 o'clock, get your tickets now. So we thought, we went to a bar, had a few drinks, went back, and we saw Tom Jones live on stage in Las Vegas. And he was just incredible, It was amazing.
Yeah, incredible artist. Another one of these that we won't have for too much longer.
Yeah.
So we have to make the most of them.
I totally agree. Right. Okay, folks. Thank you very much indeed for having joined myself, the Portmeister, and, of course, Miss Jones, the rock chick writer extraordinaire. And we will be back with you.
Put your teeth back in, Mike.
Teeth back in. That's right, absolutely. I'm having my teeth whitened again, by the way, because I saw a clip of myself on telly and I thought, oh, I've got to get them whitened again. So that's what I'm doing. Okay, folks, back with you again this time next week. Flesh Dance, what a feeling. Da, 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 da. That is one of the iconic tunes of my life.
Something about that, yeah. But, she was more famous for Fame, I think.
I don't think so. I think Flashdance was one of the greatest theme tunes to... I didn't think the film was that good. I saw the film, this one.
She wasn't in the film. She only did the soundtrack.
I know.
Yeah.
Jennifer Beals, I think, was the actress in the film, wasn't she?
I think it was,
And she was very beautiful. A ridiculous plot about her wanting to be a ballet dancer but took a job as a welder during the day. I mean, it was ludicrous and all that kind of stuff. But the sheer musical power of Flashdance, oh, I loved it.
They'll be using your name to try and get something like this off the ground.
Maybe.
So the minute you show a bit of interest, we've nabbed him, you've got Mike Parry on board, and they can then go to their potential investors and say, we've got Mike Parry. And that might make a difference in terms of bringing in the money.
It could be. I mean, I'm not a huge star, but I did start TalkSport. It became the
biggest... Don't talk yourself down, Mike.
And most successful sports radio station.
And look at the millions of listeners you've attracted to Planet Porky as well.
Well, you're absolutely right. All I'm saying is I just feel much more comfortable wearing trainers.